Africans spending 40 billion hours a year fetching water. That's the same time spent by the entire French labor market in productive economic enterprise. As Africans, we spend that time fetching water.
Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Nwokolo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. So today's episode is another insightful chat with a young man by the name of Prince Nwadeyi. I met Prince some 2 years ago at a conference, and anyone who's had the honor of holding his attention would tell you he's one of the most brilliant minds of our generations, for reasons you would find out shortly. So Prince Nwadeyi is an innovative, strategic, and solutions-driven individual who is determined to see the potential of emerging markets unleashed through the intersection of investments in innovation, in financial services, in data insights, and developing practical steps towards unlocking the potential of Africa's demographic dividend. Together with two other co-founders, Prince built a data insights and a consulting business, Ispani, while at the University of Cape Town. Ispani is a business that's focused on enabling access to critical data insights on rural and peri-urban townships in South Africa through the use of an innovative technology platform called DataRig. Their technology powers the remote collection, analysis, and reporting of granular consumer data on informal markets by a network of some 4,600 agents and boasts of many clients, including the UNDP, UNICEF, and Liberty. Prince truly is a remarkable young man when we talk about African youth who are doing amazing work, and I'm excited to share this chat with you. And so, without further ado, let's get straight into the chat with Prince Nwadeyi. Prince, thank you so much for joining me today on this bright and early morning. Greetings from the warm and consistently lit streets of Accra. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Marie. Thank you so much for having me. Sincerely appreciate it and excited to chat this morning.
Yes, indeed. And before we do that, usually to get us warmed up, I engage my audience, or I guess not my audience, the person I'm speaking with, in a very quick game to familiarize the audience with who they are. Are you ready? It's like rapid fire, but not really, but it's just about you.
Cool. No worries.
All right. So what was the first job on your resume?
I never got employed. I started a company.
Oh, well, okay then. We're sorry. Apologies. No, not even. Actually, can you tell us a little bit about this company and why you chose to start that when you started it?
Cool. I started a business called Ispani. Ispani at the core of it is a data insights business. So we provide data on the informal sector in South Africa and on the continent. We empower agent network of about 4,600 agents across SA. And really the heart behind it started as a consequence of recognizing the fact that a lot of data doesn't exist on our communities, our markets, our societies. And a lot of brands and businesses are trying to understand that, to be able to inform their marketing, their business operations, their growth, their strategy. So at the core of it, what we decided to do was to create a business that not only solves that problem through empowering an agent network of people who collect data within these markets, but far more importantly, a business that equally creates employment within these sorts of communities. And that's really what sat at the heart of us deciding to start this business called Ispani.
Oh, that's amazing. All right. I think that's going into stuff I want to talk about, but I'll come to that later. How many languages do you speak, sir?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. So I'm Nigerian, South African, or South African, Nigerian, depending on how you want to cut it. So I speak Xhosa, I speak Zulu, I speak English, I understand Afrikaans, a kind of Bikki Afrikaans for Stan and Praat. And then I speak Igbo, because I'm Nigerian Igbo by birth. And then obviously English. French is the language I wish I could speak, but hopefully I'll figure that out down the line. But that's me in a nutshell.
Me both. Oh, that's amazing. That's five of them already. Sheesh. Yeah. Okay. All right. Do you have any hobbies or skills that people don't really know about you?
Oh, my word. My clients will throw shade on me about this. I can sing. I can sing. So I actually sing. I write music. That's something that I'm deeply passionate about. So yeah, that's one thing I don't think people typically know about me. So singing, writing music, hobbies. I used to play squash. I haven't played squash in a while, and I think it's probably owing due to the history of COVID and whatnot. But yeah, I used to play squash recreationally. And what other hobbies? I write random screenplays, but I haven't shared them with anyone. Barring my friends and business partners that I irritate them with, and they're like, bro, what are you doing? But anywho, that's what I do in a nutshell. So yeah, and then I reflect on them.
And you reflect on them. That's amazing. Yeah. All right, what best describes your work day, if there's any such standard work day?
So my work day is largely two key things, mostly striking partnerships and advising clients. So a lot of the work, I sit within the confluence of having to do a lot of advisory work for businesses that are operating on the continent, who are trying to understand the informal sector quite intimately. And then I wear a second hat where we run a small debt financing business that provides credit into the informal sector. So in that business, Atana, my key agenda is really striking partnerships with capital providers, channels through which we can provide capital through into the informal sector. So that would be distribution with FMCG, because traditionally we're providing credit to independent informal traders. So that's what my day typically is spent doing, for the most part, in the context of my work day.
Right, Mr. Co-founder. Are you a zero inbox person?
My inbox is...
Come on now.
I probably have, No, I don't want to say it, but I've got quite a few emails I need to get through. But yeah, we try.
All right. What is the one skill that you underestimated, but you'd say has served you well so far in your work?
Are you not hearing this in English? so I think speaking was one of the critical things that I initially underestimated. But I recognize it's been such an important skill for me to be able to articulate, position, my thoughts and my opinions, my views, and also in many ways as well to play a role, at least in representing others where necessary. So I think that's been a critical one. The second one has been negotiation, and understanding where other people are coming from has been an absolutely critical component, I think, in my personal development and growth as an individual.
This is going off script, but how did you harness that skill? Because, you know, I've had, you know, the honor of encountering you in so many spaces, and you are such a great orator, and your ability to communicate is star level. Was that very intentional? Was that something you were always good at? And even if it was something you were always good at, imagine you sort of actively harnessed that. What was that like for you?
So, tell you a secret. So my first debating / public speaking sort of engagement was horrible, to say the least. To be quite honest, it was entirely horrible. And I really began to develop this, and people will not believe me, at least when I tell you the story, is every morning I used to get ready for school. I'd catch the school bus. That would drop me off. I went to Queens, so it would drop me off at the bus stop, and then we'd walk up with the rest of the gents to college. And in the morning, I'd wake up at 5, and literally every day before I brushed my teeth, I'd literally deliver a 10 to 15 minute speech to myself about something random, whether it's about China in Africa, whether it's about how I feel about, I don't know, what whoever's in power, whether it's about social dynamics. I was a very serious young man because my parents forced me to watch the news growing up. So it was nothing any, it was not like about a cartoon, Ed and Eddie, or, you know, Ben 10 or whatever the case may be. It was about serious topics. And I would deliver those speeches to myself, watching myself in the mirror. And that's how I actually would train, to be quite honest, every single day. And that's how I learned, okay, you need to speak slower, your pace, how your diction, your articulation, did you reflect effectively through this point? How you, so a lot of that was part of how I trained myself. And then I was also blessed to have really great coaches as I progressed and did well in public speaking. So the likes of Dan Korda, Bino Adebayo, Leander Mveka. I mean, these are all like ex-Rhodes, UCT, debating coaches from back in the day who used to coach us in high school. And they've gone on to do exceptionally well in their careers. So yeah, I give credence as well to that, and I also, I mean, it's a gift from God and a talent, so I'm grateful for that.
That's fantastic. That's some dedication right there. I mean, the lot of us have questions, but anyway, what was the last aha moment that you had, Prince?
The last aha moment that I had was when I realized that there's a fundamental difference between agency and power. That was my last aha moment. And that came as a consequence of a conversation I had recently around, in part, how we think about political systems and economic systems in Africa, and how we think about what's necessary to shift the existing institutional order that's present. And I realized in that dynamic, there's a fundamental difference between having agency and power, and the two things are not necessarily the same. But we can talk about that either now or later.
We are definitely coming back to that. I'm like, this is one of the most fascinating games I've played, because I'm like, I want to know more. Forget the game. All right. So the last question I had is, when you think about or when you hear Africa in 2050, what comes to mind?
Well, I think there are two things that come to mind. The two things that comes to mind is the fact that there is significant opportunity. And this, at the same time, the very real reality that we might still be faced with the current problems that we have today. So there's both hope and at the same time, I wouldn't say anxiety, but holding my breath. So I think I'm caught between those two parts, but lean into the more optimistic side of who I am in that particular regard, because you can't operate in Africa without optimism.
All right, no, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for indulging. That was fun. Now we're going to move over to business of the day. I think the first question that I'd like to get started with, right, Prince, is as a young, you know, South African or South African Nigerian, how have you chosen to actively engage with this project of growth and economic development, as we often say and understand it?
Okay, cool. So I think there are two components. There's the theory and there's the practical, do you know? On the theoretical side, it's to say, okay, what does this mean? What does this look like? And you read about it. And the practical side is like, what do I actively do as an individual about it? Practically speaking, I guess for myself was getting involved in entrepreneurship. I've been blessed and privileged to have been a fellow of the Alan Gray Opus Foundation. And at the very core of that institution is driving a spirit of entrepreneurship. And that's what informed my decision, along that of my co-founders, to go straight into business and not go work for McKinsey and Company or whoever else would have been great consulting firms to start off our career with. And at the core of it was the fact that we always ask the question of, if not now, then when? And if not you, then who? And I think that was the reality of what we were faced with, was to say that we have the option of either deciding to jump ship, burn our options, burn our ships, and really get stuck into finding innovative ways in which we can unlock data that can fundamentally save lives, fundamentally play the role of helping and ensuring that aid is delivered to people, like we've done with projects that we've worked alongside the UNDP and UNICEF on. And for us, the question was like, if we didn't do that, that would not have been there. And we wouldn't have the story to tell. But beyond the story to tell, I guess for us, it's also been the upside of being able to have impacted the lives of people through the incomes that we've been able to create for our agents on the ground in this particular respect. So at the core of it for us is that the practical engagement with that is on the one side, surfacing data that currently doesn't exist to fundamentally change the way in which existing stakeholders or individuals who have power and agency to think differently about the markets in which we operate and think and find innovative ways through which they can release that capital or invest more appropriately in a way that is not purely extractive, but developmental and also revenue generating and bottom line driving for them. So at the core of it, I think that's been our contribution and part my contribution in that particular regard. And then I think lastly, it's been playing the role of being a trusted advisor to certain individuals who are actively involved in thinking about these issues. And that's been a privilege that I've had thus far.
It's amazing. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I actually really love what you do, especially when we think about you. We talk about this theory, this practice, right? And especially contextually relevant practice of trying to do things in lots of the countries in our continent, Ghana, for instance, where we have so many people operating in like the informal economy, informal sector, and the amount of data, insights, and value that is locked in there because we don't access, don't know how to access, don't want to access, is huge. And it's just exciting to see that there are companies like yours whose, you know, sort of mission is to unlock the value in those spaces and to bring them into some of these, you know, conversations and things that need to be done to provide, you know, larger value, I guess, for both sides, people and the companies or organizations that want to engage them. So I always really appreciate that and glad that you're working in that space. One other thing I wanted to talk about was, you know, when you talk to people, at least when you get them to the level where they're comfortable enough to open up, sometimes there seems to be like a collective exhaustion, right, with the state of affairs, and sometimes even like some helplessness. But I remember once we spoke a few months ago, and it was this idea that, you know, you believe that people have and they must use your agency. And it's not just agency in the sense of political agency, which people often talk about, but this idea of also economic and I think social agency. Can you share a bit about your thinking around that and why you think it's important that people understand this and what it looks like to use their agency in all these different spheres of society?
Okay, so at the core of it, I think it's important for us to first and foremost appreciate the exhaustion.
We tend
to skip over it. And I think at the core of it is that where does the exhaustion necessarily come from? The exhaustion comes from the fact that there's a culture of impunity at the core of it, yeah? And impunity basically meaning that those who carry institutional, political, and in certain instances, social or economic power, who form part of the elite in certain instances, know that nothing will happen to them. Like there is no system of accountability, irrespective of the presence of the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature. This, to certain individuals, the untouchable sacred cows, and those individuals in certain instances control huge swaths of social, political, and economic influence to fundamentally affect the way in which ordinary citizens, the likes of myself and Marie, and probably some of you listening, are faced with.
Yeah.
They affect our day-to-day realities, but far more importantly, they affect the futures of our children and the generations to come. And I want to start off by saying, you know, that saying, the African saying that says you don't inherit the continent from your ancestors, but you borrow it from your children. Now, that idea is something that's fundamental to begin to enable us to appreciate the agency that we have now as a consequence. So when we think about agency at the very core of it, agency speaks to the idea of having an option or a level of capacity to do something, to act in a certain way. You have an option that's available to you. So you have the agency to be on this call. You also have the agency not to be on this call, by way of example. So the point of the matter is there is that where have we deselected our agency in the context of this democratic reality that we live in as Africans? And if we bring this to, for example, the South African context, the vast majority of the youth are not involved in voting. The vast majority of people are not involved within the electoral process. These are the very same individuals who turn around and complain about the political and economic social quagmire that we find ourselves in. So at the core of it, we need to recognize the power of the democratic instrument, at least in countries where that democratic instrument is viable and is something that is legitimate to a certain degree. For example, one of the interesting things that are happening now in Nigeria is the rise of the hashtag Peter Obi obedient sort of movement, the Nigerian elections that are happening. You've got front runners Tinubu and Atiku Abubakar. And what is happening is you're seeing the rise of the youth recognizing not just their agency, but far more importantly, their political power. And the nuance of our political power is that it's only really available for one moment, but has generational implications. Do you understand? And I think that's the critical thing that we don't recognize on the one side. But then there's also micro level agency. I talk about the need for us not just having an economic and a social revolution, but a moral revolution. The fact that certain things have actually been, it's okay to pay a bribe. It's okay to be corrupt. In fact, if you don't pay someone money to get a tender or a deal, you're seen as being inconsistent with the existing institutional praxis of the way in which business is done with public sector. And that's fundamentally flawed. So we need a moral revolution. And how we begin to shift that goes all the way down to the micro level of family, to the micro level of society, to the micro level of how you treat your neighbor, how you treat your kids, how you educate them, the value systems that we create. That's the micro level agency that we have. But we don't recognize the intergenerational persistence of that level of agency at a micro scale to fundamentally affect society as a whole. Every criminal came from a home. Every thug has a father. And that's the reality of it. And the same thing with racism and all the social dynamics that we deal with in society. No child is born racist. These things are taught, these things are seen, these things are imbibed, and effectively these things are lived out. And our political scenario, more often than not, is a reflection of the weighted average of our moral system. It's the weighted average of us as a society. The people that lead us are more often than not necessarily the best, but the convenient. And it's because people like me and you decided not to go for political office. It's because people like you and me decided not to get involved within the political process. And as a consequence, we are sitting in a situation where we have Africans spending 40 billion hours a year fetching water, which is effectively the same time the entire French, that's the same time spent by the entire French labor market in productive economic enterprise. As Africans, we spend that time fetching water. So this becomes the challenge that we begin to need to think about when we think about this notion of our agency and our power and how that manifests. And part of that requires organization, but part of that also requires individualized action, individualized utilization of your power and your agency to do something within a microcosm of society, within your circle of influence. Up until I speak to my friend and I say to him, my brother, Oga, Butwam, this thing you are doing is wrong. The law does not exist in that space. The law is not a tangible instrument in that space. That's the agency and the power I have to change my society. Do you understand? Over and above then talking about the economic consequences of being able to then raise capital, all of that stuff, start a startup, scale the business, That's a different sort of conversation. But at the micro level, those are the things that we're alienating. And that's what I think is critical for us to reflect upon.
That is fantastic. And gosh, I mean, you said so many things. And the one thing that I'm sitting here with in this very moment is 40 billion hours fetching water. when was the collective what labor it was the labor hours of like that's something to reckon, that's something to sit with. And I appreciate the sort of call, if I can call it, to it's like there's a lot that needs to be done at the organized level, but even at the individual level. And I think that's something that we take for granted, because between me and you, it's fine, it's not a big deal. But then it's actually in those little spaces, those little actions that we reinforce or don't make the difference in terms of the collective group of people. So thank you for sharing that. That was actually fantastic. And besides this little cock over here that's crowing loudly, we shall proceed. So one of the things you talked about, actually, and maybe we can explore that at some point too, but coming back to this idea of, you know, leadership and taking the reins of leadership, you've spoken some length already actually about what that would require. But sometimes too, in a lot of spaces or in some countries, it's a nice line to have, but the practical realities are different. And for some people too, they actually just don't know or don't see, either because they haven't had the example, either because they haven't been made aware that they can actually lead in some capacity. It makes it difficult, but then we are faced with, you know, the continent that we have, the challenges that we have right now, and even our feelings about 2050, for instance, right? There are opportunities for us to be excited, but there's also cause for concern if things remain the same. So what does it mean for Africa's youth? And it's a very broad categorization, but do with that as you deem fit. What does it mean for young people to take the reins of leadership today, practically speaking?
So this is a very deep question, and it's the reason why this is a pregnant question is that it's laden on other people, allowing for that to happen. That's the reality. So there's that dynamic of it, but if we take it outside of, so let's look at it at the practical level. At a practical level, it means that for us, taking the reins of leadership requires a deeper kind of engagement that we have with the existing political and economic class. And a recognition that we're not throwing the baby out with the bath water. Do you know what I'm saying? But all we're saying is that we can add shower gel to it, or we can add something else to the situation. We don't have to just, you know, bath the baby with soap. Do you understand? There's shampoo, there's baby creams, there's other things we can add. And I use this as a metaphor to say that there's an opportunity for us to work in tandem. I think that's where the issue is. And I think increasingly leaders are starting to open up to this idea, because a lot of our people across the board recognizing that technology is a critical lever for getting young people involved. Social media is a critical lever for getting young people involved. But tangibly, when it comes to this issue of fundamentally taking over the reins of leadership, I think that starts not with nation, it starts with self. And I think in order for you to lead others, you must first lead yourself. And I think that's the conversation at the core of it, is to say, how well are we leading ourselves before we decide to lead others? Number one. Number two, when we think about like the African leadership system and we think about the continent, one of the things that have actually happened is the fact that there have been vacuums of leadership. But the way nature is set up is that nature does not allow for a vacuum. So what happens is that we've seen people start taking different kinds of leadership, specifically within the context of our generation. And that leadership might not necessarily be political. It's been in the social movements. It's been in our music. It's been within our technology environment with tech startups that have been growing. It's been within certain economic environments. But the question at the core of it is to say, the nature of this leadership, is it one that has influence? Is it one that has power to affect the day-to-day realities of the ordinary person on the ground? And that's, I think, the practical implication of leadership. And I think this leadership has been there, and we've got examples of, African unicorns, the likes of your Flutter Waves that have come out of Africa. We've got really great businesses that are doing well. We've got the likes of individuals who are leading in music, our Burna Boys. Do you know who we've got? Amapiano in South Africa is a genre of music that's leading. And it's affecting different dynamics of our social, cultural, so to say, environment. But at the core of it, leadership in our context as Africa needs to have practical implications for the lived experiences of ordinary people on the ground. And if I talk about it within the context of the political and economic arena, not enough is being done by the youth. And for those barriers to be broken down at the core of it, the practical implications requires for us to have very difficult conversations with multiple stakeholders. It's not an issue of coup d'etat or seizing power. It's an issue of a shared recognition that we all have value to add in this conversation. But at this particular point in time, we've got to have a meritocracy of ideas and not so much more a meritocracy of struggle credentials or a meritocracy of I took out of colonialism. That's the sort of conversation that needs to be had. And how we bring those together to like drive practical leadership and change for people and get young people in the phrase, the critical piece.
Wow, that's fantastic. I have a question for you now. So, you know, when we talked about, you know, the Africa, what you think about when you hear Africa in 2050, you said there is some hope, although you would, you know, not exactly say anxiety, but it's a mixture of things if we don't do things right. Mm-hmm. What would things look like, right, in this better future if we were to get it? Where would the benefits show up? How would we know that we are in this better future? I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
We will know we are in this better future when Africans don't see the landing shores of Lampedusa in Europe as an option for their economic, social, and political futures and that of their generations to come. Where Oxford and Cambridge, as brilliant of institutions they are not the option for us in terms of advancing our academic future, where we recognize that within our continent lies the hopes and dreams of not just ourselves, but of generations to come, and that that practical dream and reality which we dream today has effectively been manifested. And I have no other better place to go than Africa. That is when we would have known we would have arrived there. And I think at the core of it, I think the ideal is what keeps us staying. The ideal that it is possible, the ideal that this future can be attained, that it is real, resistance notwithstanding, criticism notwithstanding, the complexities of navigating Africa notwithstanding, the continent is pregnant with immense potential, energy, youthfulness, creativity, and it's all waiting for an opportunity to be unlocked and even an opportunity to be given. And at the crux of it, if I decide to leave Africa today, I'm betting against Africa, which is what I don't want to believe in. I don't want to bet against Africa because I believe that people like you, me, are in the millions out there on the continent. And if we collectively, on aggregate, consistently to do the micro things that are right, and as we consistently grow our networks, our relationships, and we share ideas as we do in this sort of conversation, the network effect of that results in transformation and change. And hopefully, we're able to hold each other accountable and we don't become the dread of our forebearers and also of generations to come.
Good riddance. I mean, that's the mic drop moment right there. I think, ladies and gentlemen, this is the end of the tech talk. I'm glad to have facilitated this. No, actually, before you go, one last question I had for you really is, if you had the chance, Prince, to address a lot of young people, what is the message you would give them on preparing themselves to be better positioned for operating as Africans in a world that is changing so fast and will continue to change incredibly fast in some ways that we don't probably even understand or foresee yet. But what are your thoughts on preparing yourself, keeping yourself relevant, and ensuring success? It's a bit of a big question, but I just wanted to know if you had a few thoughts to share.
I have one simple thought. It's not complicated.
Yes, let's go for it.
Simple. I'll just tell them to believe in themselves and read and engage content that enables them to believe in themselves. I think one of the biggest things that we fail to recognize is every day in Africa, one of the things that happened to you as someone who is trying to change the system or bring about some social, economic, or political or business change is that the system always tells you you can't do it. And I would tell them to have such incredulous belief in themselves and to invest in their confidence, invest in their resilience, and invest in their faith, in the ideas that they have, in their skills, in their capacities. Because I think that's the biggest thing that's critical in this instance.
Prince, it's been an absolute delight having you on this podcast. Thank you so much for the time and insight as well. And hopefully I will see you soon.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me. Sincerely appreciate it. Take care.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.